Mr. Smallwood, again.
Yes, Your Honor.
We're ready for you, sir. Do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
5 minutes, yes, sir.
And may I please the court, I do represent Mr. Fitzgerald. Mr. Fitzgerald is before the court here, having entered a conditional guilty plea to the offenses, except for the misdemeanor, at which time back procedurally he couldn't do, so we handled that through a bench trial. And he was found guilty. Mr. Fitzgerald, on the 12th of May 2013, was walking down the street, minding his own business in the city of Danville. Officers Lambert and Lancaster pursued him down the street, having parked their vehicle on foot, repeatedly attempting to initiate a consensual encounter. The street, which was dark and essentially gave rise to very little in the way of observation, didn't give the officers too much to work with. This was after 1 o'clock.
Apparently, other than the nature of the area in which he was walking, the chief fact, I guess, that they relied upon is the fact that he's basically a pedestrian in the street instead of on the sidewalk. There was a sidewalk right next to him.
Right, exactly.
So he's walking in the street, and I guess they decided to stop and ask him what he was doing, correct?
And at no time, as I understand these facts, he stopped. He just kept walking away from them. He responded to their questions, where he was going,
Is it your position that there's that the facts in the light most favorable of the Commonwealth are insufficient to justify any sort of a Terry detention for investigation purposes?
Yes, I think certainly before Officer Lancaster claims that he can discern a bulge, and even after that point, we would contend that there is no reasonable basis for a Terry stop here under these facts. We have an officer who is candid that he is out there to preserve order, and that means generating stops and offenses.
I remember in Terry itself, in Terry, the case of Terry versus Ohio, which I think occurred in Cincinnati, if I remember correctly, police officer's out doing his business, walking his beat, and he sees a few guys standing outside of a jewelry store, and it's like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and the store's not open, it's a commercial area, and he thought, this just doesn't look right, but you can find out a little bit about what's going on here. Why is this any different?
Well, this is different because what we have is one pedestrian all by himself at 1 in the morning in a neighborhood that has its problems. It's what they like to characterize as a high crime area, but there's not anything going on. It's a quiet street where he's the only one out there besides the officers.
It sounds like the description of the neighborhood at least sounded to me like a situation where if the police aren't looking at a possible criminal, they're looking at the next victim, from whatever's going on in that neighborhood. I mean, shots being fired and apparently drug deals going down around the neighborhood. So it's that kind of a neighborhood, and this guy's all by himself out there in the street, not on the side, in the street at a late hour. Why? I guess my question is simply, why is it unreasonable for the police just to walk up to him and basically ask him, what are you doing here? What's going on?
Well, I mean, walking up to him and saying, where are you going? All of that. I mean, we'd sure like to take issue with that.
And if they can legitimately investigate whether criminal activity may be afoot, they're entitled to actually detain him and prevent him from walking away if that's what he chooses to do.
That's if they can legitimately do that, but we'd submit that there's not any reason to take that step from seeing if a citizen is willing to talk with them and stop and have a word to a situation where they are actually putting their hands on him and seeing if a bulge they discern is something that he shouldn't have.
Well, once the officer discerns the presence of a bulge that likely is a concealed weapon, isn't that reasonable, articulable suspicion that allows for the detention?
Well, I think in this case, no. Given the low lighting that he's described, he doesn't testify because I took a look at this quite a bit, there was a dispute between myself and the Commonwealth's attorney, and I think kind of it lands in the middle. What we've got is, it's a bulge that's sort of pointier on one side. He doesn't say, this is a bulge that I believe to be a gun. He just says, this is a bulge, and he's putting his hands in his pocket, and, you know, he feels that he's got reason to do what he did, and we contend he did not, given these facts. And certainly all of these analyses are very fact-specific. There's not a one of them in any of the trial court briefing or in the petition stage or the briefing stage that I think really comes terribly close to this.
What's your position? Does the illegal action on the part of the police begin the moment they basically pat him down? Have they done anything wrong up until that point?
I think they have definitely crossed the line at the pat down. I think from the record that we have with somebody who is on foot, who is not stopping for the police, and they're making these...
It's hard to make an argument that he's being detained if he's still moving.
Well,
I mean, so.
Certainly, but he is being asked to keep his hands out of his pockets, and I think there's at least argument, and I think that I would go there, that the police are, when things flow from this, are in the wrong when they're repeatedly asking somebody who has clearly no interest in engaging with them to keep hands out of the pockets. And so I think that there's an origin of wrongfulness in terms of naming the point where we've got to do an analysis even at that point. But if I'm wrong about that, then certainly I think at the point of the pat down.
Didn't the officer offer as an objective reason for the stop that he suspected public intoxication?
Well, he indicates early on in the testimony that Mr. Fitzgerald's words are kind of slow or perhaps slurred. But then I go through on cross-examination and I ask him about just about every single other thing I've heard in a public intoxication case, and he says, it's too dark to see that. The judge asks him and he says, I've got a flashlight, but I'm putting the flashlight on his body. He's not even trying to look to see if the eyes are bloodshot, glassy. He doesn't discern any sort of odor. Any of the things other than the slurring, he indicates they're not there.
That would suggest he didn't have enough evidence to arrest him. There's certainly no probable cause for public intoxication or any other alcohol-related offense. But that's a different question from whether that fact, along with these other facts, might give reason to investigate further, determine, you know, what, if anything, is going on, criminal or completely not innocent. I mean, Terry cuts both ways.
Oh, yes.
And either confirm or dispel the suspicions.
And I would agree with that, and I guess I would say that's sort of where I would start any of these analyses, is kind of at the probable cause and work backward. And I think the where we're at here, the officer indicated, Officer Lancaster said he had never had any interaction with Mr. Fitzgerald. He couldn't judge his
speech was slow and slurred. That might suggest he's intoxicated, might suggest he's got a speech impediment.
Right.
I mean, that might be a wholly innocent explanation for that, but the point is simply whether or not the officer's entitled to look into it and find out which is which, whether he's intoxicated or something else is going on, or whether there's a completely innocent explanation.
Right, and certainly I think that has to be looked at in terms of also there's no odor, there's no problem with
I think the point is that we're getting at is that while that is going on, while that process of determining if the explanation is completely innocent or if there's more to it, all of that needs, you know, that's permitted under Terry, and if there's suspicion or there's evidence to suggest the individual might be armed, that also permits the frisk or the pat down.
Right, and I think the way that I conceive of this record is the essentially the investigation that we're talking about is something that the officer Lancaster is done with by the time we get into this business of him observing the bulge. So I guess my understanding of these events are he's walking down the street, they are trailing behind him, they make this determination, they ask him to keep his hands out of his pockets, he puts his hands back in his pockets, Officer Lancaster feels he sees a bulge, and then they do the frisking. And so I think probably there's something to that, and I see I'm in my rebuttal bit just to quickly finish that up. Probably what I'd say to that is, yes, he can do that, but I think they were done with that by the time that matters.
Thank you. Ms. Byrne?
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the Commonwealth. There are two things I'd like to say first about this case. First of all, it is the defendant who frames the issues on appeal. And the only issue that is framed here for this court to decide is not the stop in this case, but the frisk. Because the assignment of error only addresses the frisk and the legality of that. In addition, that was what was argued below. So the stop is not before this court. The second issue I would like to mention to the court off the bat is that it is an objective standard. So it really doesn't matter what the officer said his reason was. The fact that he was not articulate doesn't mean that there weren't articulable reasons why that he offered to stop this particular defendant. And what he articulated, what the reasons that were, was that he saw a bulge. He was in a high crime area. This gentleman kept putting his hands in and out of his pockets near this bulge that he thought could be a firearm, and that he appeared intoxicated, or he believed that he was intoxicated based on his slow speech and slurred speech. So for those reasons, and because of the time of night, 1 o'clock in the morning, and that this was an area that they characterized as always having gunshots, and that he had, during the last 6 months, himself been on patrol in this area in response to drug calls and to calls of shots fired. Given that sort of background, seeing this man walking not on the sidewalk but in the street at this hour, appearing to be intoxicated through his consensual discussions with him, and having a bulge in his pocket that he would not cease putting his hand into when asked by the police officers not to do that during their consensual discussion, he had reasonable, articulable suspicion to frisk him at that point and believe he was armed and dangerous.
But the bulge was in a pocket different from the pockets in which the defendant kept inserting his hands. I may be mistaken about that.
Well, that wasn't how I read the record, but I'd have to go back and look, Your Honor. My understanding was that he kept putting his hands in his pockets and that there was a bulge that he perceived in his pocket that he believed could be a firearm. And I'm not sure that in the end matters, because if he can get his hand into one pocket, he can get his hand into another pocket before the officer can.
I'm not sure how many pockets he has, but the officer keeps referring to it as plural, pockets plural, so put his hands in his pockets. So.
I'm not sure that the record specifically limits that, but I would defer to Your Honor. Okay. I've read something other than that. Here the issue is, that were raised was the frisk proper, and here there was evidence that the officer believed he was armed, which would have both been a reasonable articulable suspicion that a crime might be afoot, which was concealed weapon and or being intoxicated in public, and that he was armed and dangerous, which could be simultaneously based on the same evidence of seeing the bulge. As soon as he put his hand on the defendant's pocket, he felt what he said he knew immediately was the rail of a firearm. And so he, at that point, certainly could have manipulated it in order to figure out whether it was a weapon. There was an argument made that it was beyond the scope because he manipulated it, but that rule pertains to when you have determined that something might not be a weapon. Of course, here he hadn't made that determination, and as soon as he touched it, he stated that he knew it was the rail of a firearm, and then of course a struggle ensued thereafter. And I would just note that although it's not mentioned on appeal, were the court to disagree with me as to the Fourth Amendment issue, there was an assault on a police officer charge, and I would certainly argue that you cannot, the exclusionary rule would not apply to that charge because that was separate and apart from
Well, the exclusionary rule doesn't, I mean, it's well settled, the exclusionary rule doesn't exclude criminal conduct that
exactly.
might occur later.
So. So it was not addressed, but were the court to disagree with me on the Fourth Amendment issue, that conviction should still stand. And unless the court has further questions for me, I would just ask that you affirm.
Thank you. Mr. Smallwood?
May I please the court? It's always of interest when I have these rare opportunities to come and have a merit argument, what tips and things I may pick up from the Assistant Attorney General, Attorneys General, I guess. And certainly I think that it's true. I didn't mention anything about the stop, just for asking in the assignment that I made. I don't know that in this case I discern any change that makes in the analysis, but certainly I think that it does speak to an interesting
Well, let me help you with that, because the law is pretty clear that stop and frisk or stop and pat down are analytically different concepts. I mean, just because you can stop and investigate doesn't necessarily mean you always get to frisk them.
Oh, yes, yes.
And so by couching, I think the Attorney General's position is by couching the assignment of error as you did, the only issue before us is really whether it was appropriate to do the pat down here.
Right, right. And like I said, I think that's really a fascinating issue that I got to think through for future improvement. But I don't know that it really puts us anywhere different that I can think of here in this case. Certainly, I can understand if I just said something about the stop. And not the frisk. There may be an issue. I guess if you all, in your wisdom, decide that there was a problem with the stop, but given that that's waived, the frisk was just fine, and or someplace different. But I don't know that I see how that can happen. Certainly, I think that we would just make the request that you reverse the decision of the trial court, remand the case for proceedings are consistent with the opinion that you make. And other than that, I don't think I have another argument unless you have questions.
Very well. Hearing none, we'll step down and greet counsel and then take up the case of Williams versus the Commonwealth.